Hello, I'm Sagar Baroshi.
And I'm John Ingold.
This is the Game Narrative Kaleidoscope podcast. Every single week, we flip to a page of the Game Narrative Kaleidoscope book and we interview a contributor about their chosen topic. It's all about the craft of game writing and game narrative. This week, we have Raquel de Miranda. Welcome, welcome.
Well, thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us here today. We would love to start by hearing a little bit about you, your background, what has brought you into the industry, whether you've been in it all along. Please give us a little roundup of your bio.
So I've been in the industry for quite some time, actually, right now. I've been in the industry, I guess, all along. I've done game design studies, and that's where I first entered the field, I guess. And then I mostly focused on narrative design, so that's my core focus, and I've done that in many different contexts. I've worked for Ubisoft, Avatar, the Avatar game, so more AAA, and then I kind of went more in the freelance kind of direction. I worked, for example, on Banishers, Ghost of New Eden, which is a .NET game, and also I've been doing smaller projects, and so yeah, basically I've kind of tried very different sizes of projects in the industry, but that's mostly where I've been, I guess.
Amazing. It's really exciting to have a kind of design first writer on the podcast, because we've had a lot of writer first podcasts. And I think that very clearly ties into the topic that you wrote about for the book. So the article that you wrote was called Economy and Commerce as Narrative Tools. So if you could sort of outline for the benefit of people who haven't maybe read it, what was it that you wanted to say? What were you thinking about?
Sure. So basically, it was kind of an opportunity for me to, briefly talk about a topic that I found really fascinating. I do think there's as a narrative designer, I come from more design mindset, I guess. And I feel like there's a huge untapped potential on the way we use economy so much in video game, because it's all a collection of zeros and ones at the end of the day. So it's addition, subtractions, and how do we place rules around that in order to make sure that the player has a good time, and that's how we control the experience a little bit, and then we can narratify it and put world building around it in a way. And that's a lot of where that's where we start to put economy in the world itself. And I feel like that's kind of inherently really interesting, because we will put all sorts of values of type of behavior we would like to see in the player more, or stuff that we would like to discourage. And I feel like it tends to be a very design focused area. Writers at best, they tend to come in and write some flavor text or stuff like that. But I feel like there's not a lot of actual collaboration that happens very often. It can, but it's still pretty rare. And I feel like there's a lot of really untapped potential there. So I kind of wanted to to dive into it a little bit. So currency, but also just pure values that we will put in those exchanges.
I've noticed, Raquel, that you have covered an enormous range of genres in the games that you have worked on, right? So not only have you had these two quite large AAA games, which themselves, I think we can call Don't Nod at this point at that level of success, but even those two are very different in themselves. But then we have The Merlies, Lighthouse, Fading Echo, Last Time I Saw You. Every single one of these are quite distinct indie games, right? Not to mention wherever your career will take you next. And I guess I just wonder, has this been something you've been able to apply in your career so far? Have you ever been the writer or been the narrative designer who's had a role in helping to influence an economy or a currency, anything like that?
To an extent, but I mean, never to the extent that I think is possible, I guess. But you have to know where to fight your battles, I guess. And not every game will be a good space in which to experiment in that area. That's a very specific way to understand narrative, I guess. But yes, I've had experiments, but to be frank, a lot of them have been generally put to the side before the end of the project, just because other stuff were prioritized. And also, like, there's still this very, like, complicated conflict of interest, I want to say, between, like, tuning and, like you need to really, like,
yes,
like, yeah, yes, shift around those numbers to make sure that the player hits exactly what you want. And I feel like narrative intent tends to be put aside in those moments for very understandable reasons, honestly. But that kind of limits the field of experimentation and, like, where you can put it. But I did, like, play around with some stuff. But generally, it's more like flavor and, like, what actually counts as a currency. I guess that's where, yeah, I did, like most of my work, I guess.
It makes sense, right? Because you mentioned this point that that there, what you're referring to, it sounds like you're sort of saying, like, balancing sometimes comes at the end, and, like, writers or narrative designers don't get to have too much of a say at that point, right? And so sometimes it's just treated as, like, this whole separate activity. Yeah, that seems like a pretty tough challenge, like, not something that you can sometimes fix if these are systems that were designed just totally outside of the department and you're not invited into, I suppose, to those talks. But is it any different if you are the whole narrative department, if you are the lead narrative designer, or you have a bigger voice? Does that make a difference structurally in how it works?
I guess it always depends on the game. Like, there are games, right, where you do have this, like, generally, not to, like, oversimplify, but I tend to feel like there are games that will put the narrative experience first, and, like, the goal will be to really have the player go through a journey, and that will be the core focus of everything you do. And in those cases, perhaps you can, like, play around a little bit more, but that will obviously still be limited because, again, not to oversimplify, but, like, those types of games are not super system driven in general. Like, they are more interested in like the aesthetic experience in a way. So you can do stuff, but only to the degree that you can actually allow resources to this kind of stuff. And also, right, sometimes you just don't want to, like, mix up different, like some players are just not into that, and that's completely fine. But then in the games that would perhaps benefit from it, then you actually have, like, a design first mindset in general, which will make, like, basically you will need to make sure that the player have a good coherent experience first. And then, again, not to oversimplify for a third time, but, like, I feel like it's perhaps a bit harder to have those collaborations between narrative and design in those kind of spaces. So you need to kind of do compromises and see what you can get from that. But yeah, it's kind of a weird spot. Like, I think it's why it's not that like people are still kind of not really experimenting with that aspect of the design field as far as, like, applying to narrative purposes.
One of the things I really enjoyed your essay. So I'm a design-minded person, but I think of myself as a writer first. But, like, obviously I've dabbled in various bits of game design before. But I particularly like this suggestion that you had of making the economy of a game dynamic, right? So that it responds to what the player is doing or responds to events in the world. Like, you mentioned the idea of a game in which there's inflation or deflation, or, you know, you could imagine commodities changing in value throughout the course of the game. I don't think I've ever seen that, even though it seems like I was reflecting on it and I was thinking that so many stories in real life or in other media are about value. They're about money and value and the cost of things and the way that the costs change and they drive people. So I guess I was trying to think, if one was to make this game for players, there's a huge weight of expectation that players have about, like, knowing they know how much things cost and that's how much they cost. Like, how might we go about easing players into this idea that they're in an environment which is actually simulating this stuff and making this stuff dynamic? Do you have any senses on how you might approach that?
I think, like, there are already games to a degree that do that. Even, like, games that we don't think of as, like, narrative. I'm going to take, like, an example that I guess, like, dabbles in that to a degree, but, like, a lot of management games, like, there is already a lot of, like, those dynamics of there are some games where it's like you are buying this amount of stuff, so now you can actually sell it to these people who want it to a higher price, but then these other people will be mad because they wanted it more even though they can pay as much and stuff like that. Like, you already have those kind of dynamics, but I feel like It needs to be part of the game loop in some way for people to want to dive into that. And I feel like in general, like one of the challenges that I find, which is very interesting, but it's kind of funny to notice, is that I feel like the risk with like a very economy driven sort of approach is that people tend to like go into like optimization mode, and basically I feel like that can really encourage people to cut off their more emotional side. Like they just don't want to think about consequences, they want to feel smart, I mean about like having outsmarted the system in a way, which is kind of also another way to think about economy in games, I guess. Like sometimes you also need to like know when to invoke this sort of emotion in a player, but also when to not do that because it's like actually undercutting something else that you're trying to do. So I feel like one of the ways to approach that is actually like, I'm going to reuse an example that I use in the game. It's kind of like one of the big ones, but like Pathologic, for example, it goes for those type of dynamics because it is a game about survival and about like basically not having control in many ways and having to understand like the logic of this weird world that you arrived into. And so I feel like basically when you put players in situations where they accept that they don't have full control and they understand it as part of the experience, they are going to be more willing to accept weird experimental stuff like that, I think.
I think that's really interesting. Like that, there's so much in narrative that fights against like standard game design, because game design is always about saying to the player, these are the rules, do the best you can. And narrative is always about saying, we're not going to tell you the rules because surprising and weird things can happen. I guess I kind of want to ask something like, are those things going to not fight against each other quite hard? Do you think players will be able to embrace this kind of narrative economy, or do you think that's going to, what am I trying to ask? Yeah, right, in the real world, bankers very much do that thing of optimizing their money and forget about the morality of them. And like, how do we stop players becoming bankers? How do we confront them with the kind of the other side of the equation? Like how much would you force that through? How much emphasis would you put on that side?
Well, honestly, I guess it fully depends on the game, because there are games in which you would want to fight against that because it does mess up with other themes that you have going on. But perhaps in other games, it could be actually interesting to let the player go wild and like full on optimize meaning out of their own experience and then like confront them with that. That could be also a different way to go about it. But again, like economy, we think of it in a very, you know, capitalist way, in a way, like it's the default in which we think about it because it's what we know. But there are other ways to like understand exchange of values or and services and stuff like that. Like it can exist in various different ways across different societies and across time. And I feel like even the choice of like how we decide to exchange stuff and like what's possible in terms of interactions we give to the player, it's already setting up expectation. And I feel like we could, like one thing I've tried to do in like in one of the game I've worked on was, for example, actually trying to not encourage that, because to me, like that was going against like the core experience that I wanted the player to have, which was something that was more community driven. And like, how do you contribute to like your place in a group, and while still keeping that into account, like how do I contribute basically? And like in this specific context, the solution was, I mean, I don't know if that was like the perfect solution, but the one we tried to experiment with was removing money and like creating a world in which it's not about money. And like, there's actually an entity that decides what type of access you have to certain resources. And you can sort of play with trying to get more of their approval to get more stuff, but you can't directly like min-max your way around like just money and like this type of stuff. And so it kind of places your priorities elsewhere, which I think is also a way to sort of play around with how do I get access to stuff? How do I evade certain experiences that we may want to explore? We may decide that actually like going against the philosophy of the game we're trying to make.
That's really interesting. So if we were to make a game with a dynamic economy, that the player was supposed to engage with and kind of have this balanced approach. Like, what kind of settings can you imagine this being in? Like, where would you, if you were directing the project, if it was your project and you were doing it tomorrow, like, where would you want to set this? Like, how, where would you take it, do you think?
I guess, like, if I really wanted this to be the core focus, honestly, like, I feel like there's plenty to do with, like, settings that are adjacent to our own. Like, perhaps we can make it a bit more fantastic in some way, or like more even more cyberpunk if we want, which is, at this point is kind of hard to do, but we can like try to push those two kind of extremes and then try to put like players in a situation where they try to have power to influence stuff and then face the consequences of that, or maybe not face the consequences of that, and that's weird too in a different ways, and then perhaps have relationship to other people, because I think as a adjacent thing, I guess, the type of relationship that people in finance or like money spaces develop between each other is super interesting, and I feel like there's a lot of inherent like narrative potential there, and like how do you kind of hype each other into those weird cycles of like trying to be the smartest person in the room while like proving that you're capable of like fully distancing yourself from consequences or seeing beyond that, and that's what's smart. I feel like that's a lot of what's going on in those spaces, and that's interesting. I feel like narratively that would also open certain doors, like we literally are playing into like what's going on, both as a mechanic and also as the consequences of your relationship to other people.
Yeah, I think that's amazing. I genuinely don't think I've ever seen a game set amongst like investment banker bros, you know, that kind of very machismo environment. But even though it's naturally, it lends itself to game design very well, because obviously it's so systemic, but and it's very narrative and it's very dramatic and those are big personalities. I've seen a couple of TV shows that have done it, but I don't think I've ever seen a game that's done it. And yeah, that sounds like a really interesting environment. I'm always excited when I hear ideas which are concepts that aren't sci-fi and aren't fantasy, but actually land in the real world, but work in a game adjacent way. This isn't a question, by the way. This is just, I think that's a great idea.
Well, let me pick up from there, because
thank you.
The thing is, actually, I'm not even sure that the critical part is the modern finance bro setting, right? Like, this has been the type of thing that is part of how humans have interacted since time immemorial, right? So perhaps something that's quite interesting is to see what it might have been like to be part of Tulip Mania or whatever it is, right? I guess the point is, like, in your game world, is there something of value and scarcity, and are people competing with it, and is that a system that you're willing to play with? And I guess that's what I wanted to pick up on with you, Raquel. So your article, like, one thing that is quite tremendous about it is you've managed to take a topic that is pretty high level for quite a lot of game design and narrative design, and yet keep it quite grounded. And the article is theoretically about how we treat value, but your a lot of your examples are about resources, about loss, about currency, about individual things that you find, rosaries and Silksong, you know, what have you, right? I'm curious what you think about items that are not that can't be depicted by like an X7. I have seven of these one thing, right? Items that are not commodities, in other words, items that are hero assets. Maybe it just strikes me. I was thinking in your conversation about valuable things, and we do put a lot of narrative value to certain objects. Sometimes special objects that you only get one of, or that it's only possible to get a certain number of, but that the game gates you from progress. Would you extend your argument to something like that, something like pieces of a Triforce for you to sort of move forward to? Or are those just different things? Or another example might be like inventory items in an adventure game where you need to collect just the right things and they're quite individual. Or does it just break down there? What do you think?
First of all, thank you very much. Very appreciated. But no, I think it completely extends. Like, I think my perspective on it would be like, technically, you can understand a lot of things under the prism of economy and like value, but especially value. Like, what you decide is valuable is like can tell you a lot. Like, when it comes just to pure like world building, like it tells you a lot about the society. Like that in a like to take your Triforce example, for example, like like in Hyrule culture, like you have like the Triforce is the center of so many things. Like it's like literally everywhere. It's plastered everywhere. It's like the core of morality. It's like it tells you whether or not someone is worthy of something and stuff like that. So there's this notion of like specialness assigned to it, but like that's completely arbitrary in some way. Like we could have had a world where the Triforce exists, but perhaps they don't care about that at all, and they care about completely like something else entirely. Like actually, those other games do that to an extent. Like the newer one, I kind of completely disinterested in the Triforce suddenly. Yeah. So I feel like there's a lot of things that you can weave into the world building just in where you place the value of stuff. And again, like, or for example, you could take a completely different example where like something that is perhaps like, I don't have a specific game tied to that, but a random example, perhaps like you just pick up pebbles while you are walking around and you have like 98 pebbles in your inventory. You have no idea what they do and you just pick them up. Then suddenly you pick a pebble and this pebble is just not counted as any of the pebble. So suddenly it's just, right. It's its own thing. Like that's weird and like that feels different. So perhaps you would like be, okay, it's, that must be something. Perhaps like just doing stuff like that, you can already like, mess with like expectations and like how the player like interact with stuff. Like I feel like basically how you decide to categorize and or like just the price that you place on an item, you know, in an Elder Scrolls game or something like that, suddenly you pick something and it's like super valuable. Why? Like that's already intriguing in itself.
Well, I mean that's actually quite a good example of the like the Elder Scrolls games, right? Because you will get that like there is like a coin value for everything. So you have a bar against which to measure that, right?
Yeah.
For some other games, you're sort of, it's whatever the player has in their head. And that can be hard to measure. But I suppose like these large big games that are trying to do this, where they're like, in this city, it's worth this much. And this one, it's this much. They give you something to bounce it against. And that that's a way through this puddle. Because in real life, like we're always in a state of confusion over what something is truly worth. Like we're relying on all of these signals that we just don't have in a game world, right? To determine that. So that's a very good point. That's a very good point.
I think one thing I think is really interesting is the idea of just the simplest example of it is just a trading game, right? Isn't it? Like a narrative trading, like there's all these big open world games, there's your Horizon Zero Dawns and things. And I don't think I've ever played one where like one city has a lot of feathers and they don't care about feathers, but if you take the feathers to the other city, they go, oh my God, we've never seen these things before. This is worth a lot of money. I guess taking that design to its extreme, like if one made a game set on the Silk Road and you play as Marco Polo trading things to China, which China needs, which I'm not sure what he traded, and then taking silks back to Europe. How do we stop the player from just grinding this thing into oblivion because that's what players do? Like how do we bring the narrative? Because if we just give them the systems, they'll do the systems thing. We need to somehow hammer them with the narrative. So how do we, what are our axes to move on that? How can we stop the player just sort of doing universal paperclips on every single game in this mold that we make?
I feel like it's going to be hard to stop inherently, honestly, because like it's a very player instinct, like number go up is very much anchored in player behavior most of the time. But I do feel like there's potential ways to like sort of affect that, I want to say. Like, for example, yes, like you could have narrative consequences to doing that. Like perhaps the game actually noticed that it's doing that, and like perhaps like the merchant you keep on trying to do that with at some point is like, okay, so you don't respect me, and suddenly you can no longer trade with them, and like that creates tension and stuff like that. Like we could imagine that, for example. But also like one of the, I think I put that example in the article, but like you could use that like and know that the player will do that. Like, for example, I think like
Temi Village.
Yeah, exactly. Like in that case, it was like, yeah, so the player will notice the loophole and they will exploit it and it will be funny. And it's funny, it's right. So I feel like knowing that, like anticipating that the player will try to be smarter than whatever system you are putting there, that you actually have opportunities there, I feel.
Yeah, and you could even set it up as a narrative trap, I suppose, that like we expect the player to do this, and when they do it, we go, ah, well, you knew that was coming, and here is the consequence of that. Yeah.
Or you could make a point out of it, I suppose, right? Like you could pair these ideas you've had, Raquel, in your article, right? You could say you are the cause of a massive debt cycle in a place because you have extracted all of the resources from this zone, right? Especially because games love mining, right? Like, I mean, maybe you just mine it all and it's done, and you think you're just grinding. I mean, this is actually what Undertale does really well from a different perspective. Yeah. Is it just sort of lets you flow into typical player behavior until it bangs you over the head with it. I mean, it does strike me that there's like a big hole in the market for something that makes a point this way.
Are we as narrative designers a little bit scared of anything that's dynamic, though? Like where it's kind of reacting to the player in this way?
Like... I think that's fair enough, honestly. But like, there's good reason for it. Like, it's like anything that's not fixed is another system to take into account.
Chaos.
Another thing that can break. Yeah,
exactly. And like, it's true that in a game where you already have so many things to like look for and glitches in particular, like stuff you want to make sure that you want to control, it's hard to know when to take that risk and when it's worth it, and also when it's going to work, because that's the issue with like stuff that hasn't been experimented with that much, is like you don't know if that's a good idea on paper or if actually you put it in the game and it does exactly the opposite that you expected. I mean, that's still interesting to know, but I feel like it makes sense not to do these kinds of experiments in games that would perhaps have the complexity of system to support those. So I feel like that's partially why it's kind of still relatively underexplored.
Right. You have to find the right size of project to be able to do this kind of experiment without it getting in the way of everything else.
Exactly. Yeah.
And it's a little difficult to put into a PowerPoint deck to a publisher to say, like, you know what this game's really going to be about? We're ready. This is going to be the killer feature. When in fact, it might well be, right? It might be the thing that works. And I think actually a lot of games sneak it in. I think this is part of why survival games are so popular these days, because they're fundamentally about currency management, right?
Yeah.
You just have a bunch of different currencies and the stakes feel really high. And same with management sims and things like this, right? Because they are just currencies. Like the currency might be time. It might be how many, you know, like how many sticks can I rub together to make a fire? And therefore, how many fires can I have to make iron or whatever it is, right?
Yeah.
I do think they kind of play with it in this way. You point out, right? Like you point out in your article that sometimes it's valuable to put friction in the economy. Like sometimes you actually want something that's a little bit incorrect or a little bit inefficient. You have this Temmie example, but you also have this classic example of, you know, you don't have to have something be saleable for the same amount everywhere in the world that you go. And it does strike me that maybe it's in those moments of friction where maybe we can derive some stories or we can have some individual moments. But I guess what I wonder is, are we always having to put those moments in conversations with merchants? Like does it always have to happen in the course of like a transactional dialogue sequence that with someone where one option is always, let me see what you have for sale today, right? Is there another way that we can handle that?
I'm sure there is. I actually think that trying to put it like in systemic, like in systems that are there to just facilitate the player's life might actually be detrimental if it's not really, really, really well conceived, because then it becomes like, again, friction can be good, but it can also get so annoying that it just like discourages the player from interacting with whatever you want to say altogether. So it's kind of a fine line, I think. But again, like it's just like we understand merchants in games in a very specific way too. Like merchants is like, I'm behind my counter and I'm going to tell you my little like pre-recorded line that I have three of them, and so that's how we understand that. And it's kind of like just a little guy in place of a menu, basically. Like it's basically just a way to a menu, and sure, like that's very efficient, that's a good way to do that without completely breaking immersion. But perhaps there are different ways to understand merchants. Perhaps like merchants could be complex characters, like it's not impossible, and they could have storylines, and perhaps the way you exchange stuff could be more narratively supported.
Yeah, I remember playing, I think it was Assassin's Creed Origins, the one that's in Egypt, and you go up to merchants in that and you say, you know, how much does this cost? And they tell you, and I was like, I've been to Egypt. That is not how merchants in Egypt work. At least not in the tourist places near the pyramids, it's not. Like, it's haggling the whole way down. I think, like, I kind of love it. Like my mind's sort of racing with these ideas. And I'd love to see a version of The Witcher in which, you know, if there's, you know, those notice boards in the village where they say like, oh, you get 500 gold pieces if you can kill the spider monkey thing. And like, if you say, well, I'm going to not do that today, because if I don't do it today, the value of that spider monkey will go up. Like, yeah. How long can I leave it until like it's just eaten the people who are going to pay?
Yeah.
That would be incredible. And to bring that sort of, it's almost like the sort of gambling mechanic you get from card games where you kind of up the stakes and then you see how much you can cream off. And no one's, I really haven't ever seen that in a kind of...
I saw one a couple months ago, which is actually.
Mm. Oh, did you?
Yeah, but it wasn't too heavily narrative. It was more clearly a system. It was in an indie game called Tiny Bookshop, which was a cozy game about running a bookshop in a small town. And a big part of the game turns out to be inventory management, like buying new books, and you don't know what you're going to get. It's like a little bit like a pack of Pokemon cards or something. But you know it's going to be romance or it's going to be horror or something. If you don't buy it, the classifieds ad will offer more the next day. But you don't know when they're going to take it off of the market or when someone else in the game is going to buy it.
Yeah, yeah.
So the idea is like, you can wait. Oh, sorry, the other way around. Like they'll put a discount. They'll put a discount on it because they want to get it off. They want to get off their hands. Mm. But you don't know when they're going to just burn it. Whatever it is. So yeah, there's this game of like how long you can wait, and time itself is a currency there, like how much you can sell in a given day, how many turns you can have. But yeah, there are a lot of systems in that game actually. Yeah, that are attempting to do things like this. But I feel like I have seen these types of clocks before, these things where like things run down. It can be hard to tie a lot of narrative to it. I suppose maybe Citizen Sleeper is another example where you might have like clocks running that are adding up to some sort of end, and some of those are running on time and some of those are running on like human interactions, and those can be moving at different speeds based on different player behavior. One is just happening, the other one is happening every time you make an attempt and fail, you know, and then it goes worse. I asked my initial question, which is about, well, how expansively should we be thinking about the economy? Because it's almost like we're talking about all the game systems in the game, right? after
kind
a little while. Right?
Yeah, that's I feel like that's part of it too. Like when you start working on a game, you kind of need to decide which part is which, basically. And that's, I feel like we tend to understand it in a very like, strict way, you know, like it's like, oh yeah, economy is when money, right, basically. And but actually those are kind of arbitrary. Like you could redefine those depending on the game. Like maybe it makes sense in a game to just like do it, yeah, okay, so economy is money and anything else is other stuff, and we don't touch that and we touch this instead. But there are games I feel where it could be interesting to wonder what belongs where, basically, and who is whose input would benefit from like enriching the system.
It's like that's in every game, right? Like absolutely. Like you're making a statement that's pretty profound, actually, that I guess I don't think I've thought about it in this way, that in some ways you think you're playing, right? But all you are doing is moving value around on the board, and whatever that board is for you, right? And the more elegantly we can get you to do it, and the more we can get you to focus on the bits we want you to, the better of an experience you have, and perhaps the better of a job we've done, right? As narrative designers and as writers, like it matters a little bit less what the flavor text is and what we've done for it, as much as what matters is the feeling that you feel from engaging with the system. Like, is this something you want to do, or are you focused on something else, or something that feels otherwise? Because I guess I wonder, if you were put on a game where the economy isn't a major priority, it's not part of the core game direction, it's not part of the core vision, but you felt there was some sort of angle that could be done, maybe as a slightly optional feature, which of these, we've covered a lot of different topics here, right? So I'm curious, is there like a priority list that you could give to a producer where you could say like, hey, this is like the one of the lightest touch ways that you can add narrative value to the economy into the game. This is a little bit heavier, but you have a better bang for your buck. How would you sort of order that? What would you do first?
Oh, that's really interesting. I guess it depends on the game, but we are going to pretend it depends on the game a little less than it does. I guess like it starts with flavor text. Always like it starts with like identifying, okay, so where can we actually like wrap this mechanic with some explanations on in lore logic, who's like we have NPCs are like connected to that in any way. Can we like tie their character arcs to this in some way, like to make feel to make the player feel like I spent this money, that allowed this character to actually like get access to this resource, and now they can open the farm they always wanted or whatever. So that would be a way to do that that is pretty removed from the system itself. So I guess like first it's just like flavor text, then there is like okay, can we like connect quests to that, stuff like that, and then when we get deeper it can actually be like, okay, so what's like what feeling do we want to infuse into like earning like the currency or like spending it, or like what can we buy, how does that make us feel, does that like contribute to the character's progression in some way, is there like some kind of morality tied to that, and then like we can go as far as we want from there basically, but I guess like it would be first wrapper, then emotional connection, and then like the actual system.
Okay, so you think there is value in the kind of just in the way we describe the economy to the player, even before we get into the kind of systemics of it, and just sort of trying to really think about that and ground the economy in the fiction and the characters of the world a little bit more.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, that's most of what we will do, in honesty.
Realistically, like... true, yeah.
As both writers and narrative designers, like generally we see what, like where there is like space for to write things, and then we see how we can best invest that, I guess. Mm. But then... Mm. Yes, like obviously, and again, like that's kind of the narrative designer side of me talking, but like the more we interconnect everything, the better everything will be, like obviously. But also it's worth it to know when it's actually a hindrance rather than a help, I think. Like knowing where to stop is always very important, and knowing where to like leave stuff to other departments, and seeing where we can do the maximum impact with the minimum like danger to the production pipeline, or like trying to reassure people that we're not going too crazy, stuff like that. Like there's a balance to find, I think.
Yeah, because there's quite a common problem when narrative design gets quite systemic. We can sometimes start simulating things because they ought to be simulated in the world, and not because they're actually very interesting to simulate.
Exactly. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And that's definitely worth avoiding. I love the world building aspect of it. And that's kind of interesting. I wondered if there was anything you wanted to say about that specifically. So, I mean, in the article you mentioned basic things like the sort of the choice of the currency. It tells you something about the world, the choice of what's valuable. And we've also talked about how that might sit within a kind of wider open world game in which what's valuable tells you something about a particular part of the world. That's really interesting. And I think, you know, when we're building worlds, especially kind of imaginative ones and creative ones, that idea of what's valuable to these people is like one of those core world building questions. Do you think there are interesting things we can be doing even with that level of it, even if we're not doing anything systemic, we're just thinking about value? Are there interesting lenses for that, or interesting ways we could be thinking about that? Do you think perhaps we're not engaging with as an art form at the moment?
I think a lot of I think a lot of games do play with that quite a lot already, but I feel like there's always this notion of like, you know, for example, let's say you have a specific culture and for some reason they don't like gold. Gold never took off in their culture for some reason. I'm sure there's a smart reason in the lore, and they're still at copper, and copper in like is like the most interesting, it's like the most valuable thing to them. For example, perhaps like they used to have huge copper mines, and then they all like went dry, and so it's kind of like a remnant of the past, of like the golden age of the civilization, perhaps they wouldn't call it that, and then like perhaps all of the nobles actually have like or like people who have a lot of power, they have like a lot of copper on them, like perhaps they have like all of this like oxidized copper, and like that's how you can tell them apart in a crowd and stuff like that, and perhaps they don't value the same thing in someone, like instead of something being shiny, but perhaps they are more interested in something being like bendable that you can mix with other stuff, like there's that could affect the way they speak, like what they like, what qualities they could find in some people, and also like what access to like the tools to which they would like access or not. Like in that case, perhaps they don't have access to copper that much, so they wouldn't do a lot of stuff with copper. They would do stuff with other material. Like, I mean, we can go on basically, but I feel yeah.
Please go on. I mean, I feel like what a tour de force. I feel like in the space of 2 minutes, you've come up with a random element and have designed an entire culture very, very consistently on the basis of this. This is fabulous. Well, don't stop.
I wanted to jump in and ask is, you know, for you, if you were doing world building, because I'm interested in game design and I'm interested in systems, but I'm also just really interested in people, right? In the actual people who do the writing and how they approach it. So for you, when you're designing a world and you're designing a culture, is the copper mines closing down? Is that your way in? Is that a way that you start? Is that a question that you've actually sort of tend to use? Or are you just riffing for the sake of this podcast and actually normally you think about something else completely? How do you go about building a world? What's core to you?
Oh, that's really interesting. I guess it completely depends. Like, I think the way I tend to approach things is I really like when people already thought of things before I arrived, basically. And so there's already like some degree of ideas.
I know what you mean.
And so there's like, because I feel like the initial part of world building, like when there's really nothing, that can feel a bit arbitrary to me to a degree. Why anything instead of anything? I don't know. So I feel like when someone already feels strongly about something, you can kind of come in and try to get interested about those ideas and see like what feels special and what feels specific and unique about like what already exists basically. And then I like to go from there and like sort of unravel the logic to a certain degree, but kind of always trying to keep people in mind, because I feel like one of the dangers, maybe not a danger, but like something that world building can do is forget that people are complicated, that they are, they will have like conflicted opinions about stuff, that they will like have a very human way of like looking at stuff, and I feel like if we lose the emotional core of where we take certain world building decisions, then we can kind of lose our way a little bit. Like we can start to have a lot of ideas and then forget what they mean to someone who will interact with them. So I try to not lose sight of that and stay at that level.
So the constraints are good, and then you approach it with quite a problem-solving kind of way and a kind of very logical way, but trying to keep it grounded on the human experience in the world. Makes perfect sense. Thank you. It's a great answer.
You're giving us too many like great answers here, Raquel. So you're stumping us. I have a question that is maybe a little bit out of left field, I suppose, but it definitely came up for me in my background because I've worked on multiplayer games before, and I think for quite a lot of this, we tend to think of how tough of a challenge it already is to manage a single player roaming around in your world, right? But if you have multiple people roaming on your world, and I met some people who worked at CCP Games who run EVE Online, and I was chatting with them about how they keep their player economy going, and it's almost entirely run by players. Players in EVE for you know decades literally have been like producing their own materials. They've been trading with each other. There's like an active currency trading system that kind of happens live, and that might be an extreme example, right? But if we take some of your lessons, do you think that these generally are likely to apply to multiplayer setups as well? Or obviously it depends on the game, but perhaps maybe a better approach is, what are the relevant questions you would ask if you were brought onto a multiplayer project and asked about putting narrative into the economy? How would you start to slice that problem down?
Oh, that's a really great question. Honestly, like, yes, there's a multiplayer side of the economy is a whole thing, and it's really interesting, but it's really complicated, and it's kind of like overlapping but also not. But I guess it depends on like the state of completion of the multiplayer game. Like if it's already live, it's like a completely different beast, I think. But like if it's still in pre-production being like considered, I think one of the core question, which is a very like, it's a very design question, I think, but I feel it's still important. It has narrative implications in a way, in terms of how it shapes the player experience, is what are like, what tools do we give the player to influence their economy? Like, how do they communicate among each other? What can they sell? And like, what's the experience of like selling? Because, you know, like, you have, I'm not a huge on multiplayer games, so I might say stupid stuff, but like, for example, sometimes you have games where you go to like a plaza and you need to be in this space to actually like do a transaction, and there are games where you actually go to a menu to do that, and it depends on the on the type of transaction. And also, like, there's a actual like shop to buy like cosmetics and stuff like that, which is yet another layer of it. And like, how do you integrate that within the logic of the world or not at all? And that's completely different. Like, so I guess all of those questions of like, how do we ground stuff, and what are the literal like buttons that the player will be able to push to do the things, and what are the limitations on that? I think that would be my main questions, to see how type of experience it gives. Yeah.
Because these questions are trying to establish, well, what mindset is the player in when they're doing this? Do they feel like they're working with the developer of the company and they're deciding whether to pay them for something, or do they think they're having a social interaction with a fellow player, and they would be in such a different mode and might be very differently willing to expend or to sort of purchase in that scenario. Yeah, no, I think that makes a tremendous amount of sense. And of course, these games, especially multiplayer games, they create value and make decisions of what value they want to capture, right? So, you know, we have all those like classic stories of like World of Warcraft accounts being sold. This still happens, of course, for multiplayer games all the time. And that's all this value that's happening and being traded outside of these games, right? But yeah, so I mean, I suppose everything is a choice, right? Everything is a design decision of like what you want to keep in the house or not.
Yeah,
really clear. Yeah, it makes sense.
Okay. I think The core question of what do the buttons actually do? It's a funny how I think that's so fundamental to narrative design, actually, in all contexts. And we don't often talk about it somehow because it feels like it's almost too simple a thing to say. But actually, it's really fundamental because that's what the player is actually doing. I think we've been talking for quite a long time. It's a really interesting topic, but I think we'd better wrap it up there. I did want to call out one other thing in your article, which we didn't really talk about, which was you commented on the player's urge to make the numbers go up the whole time, and like asking the question, you know, is that something that we always want to be doing? I also think that's a brilliant insight, actually, and one that's often undervalued in games in general. Like, can we make games where the player doesn't always have their numbers going up without them getting pissed off and walking away? I think that's something that narrative is really important for, but perhaps that will be another podcast to talk about, unless there's anything you particularly want to say on that topic straight away.
Honestly, like, most of what I would say I've already said, in a way. Like, it's all choices and like what type of experience you want the player to have and how much you want to control that or like embrace the player tendencies, and what does that say about the type of experience you want to give them and how comfortable you feel about the type of experience you provide, I guess.
Yeah, so it's back into that question of, do we lure the player into making the numbers go up and then hit them for it, or do we trap them in a loop of that? Amazing. It's been a really, really interesting conversation. I'm brimming over with ideas from it. So thank you very, very much for joining us. It's been really great. And otherwise, dear listeners, please join us again next week when we will open the kaleidoscope again and interview another luminary of the game design and writing field. But for now, thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.
Goodbye.